Which is better, to express grief and pain by using tear ducts especially created for the purpose, or to express grief and pain by enduring a silent, secret hemorrhage of the soul?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
We've been in Matthew chapter 5 now for several weeks, and we're going to continue again, and who knows how long it's going to take us, right, Jack?
Right.
I guess our purpose here has never been to go fast, but to be as thorough as we can, to make it as practical to life as we can. So what we're doing in Matthew 5 is the Beatitudes, and it's been so long, Jack, since we began the Beatitudes. Could you one more time define what that word is? What does Beatitude mean?
It comes from the Latin. Our English translation has, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, blessed are those who hunger and thirst, and that. So each of these starts with that blessed are, and in Latin that's, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's from a word that we get beatitude from, and it just means blessed in Latin. What does that mean? It basically means having received a blessing from God, having received a divine blessing.
So the Beatitudes are blessings from God.
Yeah. Those who are a description of those who are going to, as we have interpreted it, a description of those who are going to receive that ultimate and final blessing from God.
You know, it's interesting that I just thought of, Jack. Lots of times there's people who talk to me about the promises of God, and they'll quote different things that God has promised us and to kind of hang our hope on. And I don't think I've ever had the Beatitudes included in those promises. I think perhaps because these are not easy things. These are not things that initially feel comforting to us, like blessed are those who mourn or blessed are those who hunger and thirst, are not things that we really have a passion for innately.
Right.
It's something that we have to acquire a taste for.
Yeah, as we've
through
seen,
understanding.
There's a real irony in all of these, on all of the Beatitudes along the lines of what you're suggesting, that we don't, the ones that he's saying are going to receive this blessing are the downtrodden, the poor in spirit, the losers, the unsuccessful, the not the shining ones, but the dull ones, not so shining ones. And we don't.
Or the hurting ones.
The hurting ones, yeah.
The sad ones.
So we don't gravitate toward that exactly.
No, we don't. But the irony has been a beautiful thing to listen to, and I sure would encourage people who have just started listening to us to go back and maybe order some tapes from McKenzie Study Center in Eugene and perhaps catch up to where we're at, because these are very encouraging.
Yeah.
So today we're on number 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy.
Okay. Pattern, if you will remember, the pattern is to the first beatitude was, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The last beatitude is, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In between, all of them have a variation on what it is that's promised them, but I think the fact that it's sandwiched between, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven on either end, is a kind of a literary clue that he intends us to understand that all of these things are basically about our eternal reward. So what's the mercy that we will receive? For they shall receive mercy. It's the mercy of being granted an inheritance in the kingdom of heaven, essentially. Instead of God looking at us and evaluating us objectively as unworthy and therefore destroying us in however he's going to destroy us, he grants us citizenship in the kingdom of heaven in spite of the fact that we're not worthy of that citizenship. That's the ultimate mercy that God will show. And I think that's what he has in mind here. So all of these are, how do we get into the kingdom of heaven, basically? He's answering the question, how will we see God in the kingdom of heaven? And so this one is by being, if we are among those who are merciful.
So merciful is a word that we use a lot, but it's a very powerful word. Can you?
We do in Christian circles. Do we out on the street in our culture?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know. Yeah. I just hear it so much in the people with whom I associate that.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't. That's a good question. How much currency it has in the wider culture, but certainly in Christian culture, we do. There are actually a couple of ways that merciful can be used, and I think probably a couple of ways that is used in the Bible. At times, merciful can be used just as kind of a synonym for compassionate, to be genuinely, practically, concretely helpful to people out of compassion, to help meet their needs, to meet them at a point of need. The other way it's used, and more predominantly, it's used as a synonym for forgiving. The key concept is forgiveness, and I think that's what Jesus has in mind here. Blessed are those who have a spirit of being forgiving toward other people, instead of having a heart that requires that other people get it for them having gotten me. Instead of a vengeful spirit, I have a spirit that is willing to let go the offenses that they have perpetrated against me. I'm going to let it go, really resolve it in my heart to let it go. And if we look at the rest of Jesus' teaching, the ground for us doing that is because we have been shown so much mercy. Probably the most significant parable is that deals with this is the parable he taught about the man who owes some king, I think it is, just a gazillion dollars. And he comes before the king and he pleads for mercy. He says, there's no way I can pay this off. And the king grants him mercy and says, okay, you don't owe me anything. I cancel the debt entirely. And the guy goes out from the king and meets somebody on the street who is a debtor to him, who owes him a couple pennies, and demands that the guy pay him his couple pennies. And I think has him beaten or beats him up because he doesn't have his, because he won't pay him. The king finds out about that, has him drugged back in, and says, you wouldn't forgive this guy the couple pennies, then neither will I forgive you the gazillion dollars, and send him to debtor's prison.
Gazillion dollars, is that what it says in the Bible?
It's a number of talents. That is an astronomical number of talents for that time.
A gazillion number of talents.
Yeah. So what Jesus, and then he ends that by saying, if you show no mercy, no mercy will be shown to you. That Jesus sees is a clear correlation between the person who is accepting mercy from God and the person who's granting mercy to others. If we don't grant mercy to others, then we haven't really received the mercy of God. And the psychology of that is interesting.
Received the mercy of God, you mean understood the mercy of God?
Yes, acknowledged it, welcomed it, and embraced it. Now, which seems odd because, of course, I've received the mercy of God. I mean, I want it. I want him to forgive me. I want him to not hold my sins against me. But I think what Jesus is saying is the psychology of it is we haven't really received it as mercy. We've probably received it as what is my due.
Okay, so if I can't forgive somebody else, whatever they've done to me, then that's probably an indication that I've kind of felt entitled to the forgiveness that God has given me, or just feel like it kind of should be mine, or it just is mine. It's that free gift that doesn't have anything to do with the state of my heart.
Right, and doesn't have anything to do with the profound mercy of God's heart. That I think that's what Jesus is getting at, is that I just know this so well from my own life, from my own earlier period in my life, where I did not understand the mercy of God, because when all was said and done, I did not see myself as unworthy. I saw myself as worthy. Yes, I was a sinner. The creeds told me to say I was a sinner, so I said I was. Did I believe it? Well, yeah. I mean, I was a sinner like everybody else. But as sinners
really
go,
it,
I was so much better than all the rest of those sinners.
Mm-hmm.
And so being so much better, if anybody is worthy, it's me. So if I were God, why wouldn't I forgive Jack? I mean,
after all, you're better
forgiven,
than most of
right?
the people in your dorm room.
Exactly.
Dorm hall.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't really receiving God's mercy as mercy. I was receiving it as kind of a reward for good behavior, a reward for being a basically good person. Well, that's not comprehending nor really welcoming and embracing the mercy of God as mercy. And what Jesus is saying is, if you don't get to a point where you recognize your need for mercy and then turn to God and see it and acknowledge it and accept it, there is no forgiveness for you. The people who take forgiveness for granted are not going to see the kingdom of God. And one of the signs that we are among those people who don't take forgiveness for granted, but actually recognize it for what it is, the profound and deep mercy of my Father, is that we will try to emulate that mercy toward other people. It's not a matter of them deserving it, it's a matter of me granting it. That's what mercy is. And what we do is we have this double standard that we apply. We look to others and we say, I can't forgive that. They don't deserve it. You know, that I can't forgive them because look at what they did to me. What they deserve is to be crunched for what they did to me. And what I'm saying is true, what I'm seeing is true, but the hardness in me is an unwillingness to look past the fact that they deserve to be hurt and to instead grant them mercy because of my heart, out of the compassion, out of the tenderness of my heart. That's what God has done for me. Why don't I see that that's what I should do to them? Well, but I don't see that that's what God has done for me if I have not acknowledged my own unworthiness.
Okay, here's how I think it, though, works out in our life, Jack. I think there comes a real crossroads in our life very often for most people where there's a situation that happens in their life that for them is absolutely excruciating. Somebody has wronged them in a way that just is impossible for them to take in or to forgive. There's lots of reasons that they might have not to forgive, but bottom line, it's because we haven't been taught about our need for forgiveness yet. I think that's probably the bottom line, and maybe this is the time where God is going to humble our hearts. That humility of our heart is something that may take a very long time. So, for example, if my husband left me and had an affair with somebody else, and I was a young believer, either in age or just young in that I hadn't grown up much yet, then I would have a very, very difficult time truly forgiving because I hadn't perhaps learned the need for my own forgiveness. I hadn't seen the evil in my own heart, the pain in my own heart, the wrongness, the sin in my own heart. And perhaps this is the time that God's going to teach me to forgive. Lots of people want to jump over the process of God teaching me my need for forgiveness in order for me to...
My need to be forgiven.
To be forgiven, mm-hmm. in order to forgive others. And I think it's a cognitive thing, that what I do is I just then say, okay, I forgive that person, put it aside and walk away as though it's happened. And I see this over and over in my counseling, mm-hmm. Jack, mm-hmm. that people haven't indeed forgiven. They've said the words, and they might even have believed that that's truly what they've done. But they come up to a place where there's a very difficult situation in their life, and they just can't believe. Can't forgive.
Yeah.
They just... There's all sorts of reasons for it that they might give, like, gosh, if I forgive this person, then it's saying it's okay what they did,
right.
Or it's okay that they hurt me, or that they can do it again, or that it doesn't matter, or, you know, they come up with all sorts of things that really make sense on one hand, but the bottom line is, again, I can't forgive because I really haven't been taught in that area by God yet.
Right.
My heart has not been softened in such a way that I see my need for forgiveness such that I can forgive the other person. That process of God teaching me that could be years and years in the making. So if my husband left me today for another woman, it could be that it might take me 5 years to really, truly forgive him. Because I might have to go through a whole process of sanctification that teaches, that softens my heart toward him. Now, all that time, it isn't as though I'm saying, I'm not condoning, clenching my fist and saying, I will not forgive, and okay, maybe in 5 years. That's not what I'm talking about at all. There may be times when I clench my fist and say I won't, but overall, what I want is to be softened by God. I want to be a forgiving person. I'm just not there yet. That is such a freedom for people to be able to have that reality. Because I have people that come to me and say, okay, I've got to forgive this person now, but I can't do it. Well, very many times, there is a whole lot of gymnastics that God puts us through this situation to teach us a huge amount of things, and to try and go over that process too quickly, I think is really aborting the sanctification of God in my heart that will eventually lead toward forgiveness.
Yeah, if people are doing it too quickly, then obviously it's not really authentic to start with, and probably instead what they're doing is what they're calling forgiveness, a deliberate voluntary amnesia. You know, they're mm-hmm. trying to kind of stuff it somewhere in their minds where they're pretending like it never happened, and they want to get on with their life as if it never happened. That's not forgiveness. Forgiveness is something that you grant, saying, I want good for that person, in spite of the fact that in view of what they did to me, they deserve punishment. They deserve to be destroyed for what they did to me, but I don't want their destruction. I want good for them. But I can't. But I have to be saying that as I'm looking squarely into the horror of what they did to me, and how atrocious it was, and how utterly perverse and cruel and evil it was. To deny that it was perverse and cruel and evil is not forgiveness. That's something. I mean, that's just a kind of self-denial.
And the self-denial might not only keep me from forgiving them, but also keep me in a hardness of heart. Because perhaps the reason I cannot look squarely at the horror of what they've done might reflect on me that I'm not a person that's likable. And so my husband left me because I'm not likable. And that's something that is excruciating to me. I've always worked very hard at being a likable person, so it really crashes into the reality that I believe about myself. And so it's not only that I don't want to see the horror because I don't want to see them, I don't want to forgive them, but also because I don't want to face into perhaps this crisis in my own perception of myself, mm-hmm. which is part of the sanctification that God wants to grow in me.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is probably what you mean, but I would say it stronger. It ultimately confronts me with the fact that I'm evil, not just not likable, but that I am evil, like the person who hurt me. That not only are they cruel and thoughtless and foolish and evil, but ultimately, if I'm going to open my eyes with that kind of objectivity, then I need to open those eyes on myself as well. And one of our strategies for avoiding that is, well, I won't look at other people that way either.
Right.
And so then I don't have to look at myself.
Exactly. But that's one step down from where I was even going. I absolutely agree with that, and I think that's the ultimate of where we need to go. But I'm even thinking in my daily life, there's lots of layers that keep me from seeing mm-hmm. the reality of God in my own life, or the reality of my heart. I have lots of idols. One of my idols might be that it's so difficult to not have the whole world like me or admire me or see me as somehow very special that I can't stand that my husband left me and said, in essence, you're not special, because I've worked so hard at making that my crutch, making that my life, making that my idol. So it's kind of a step even before I see the sin in my heart. I have to look at the way in which I've protected myself, even several layers above looking at that. And those layers that God peels one at a time is part of the process of sanctification in my life.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Yes. God leads me to him by smashing the idols that I have distracted myself with, the things that I'm really making my life all about. He destroys them and says, now will you come to me? And it can either open us up It can either tenderize us and make us willing to pursue the truth, or we refuse to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, those are the crucial times in our life that are the turning points. We go one way or the other.
And
we
let
either
me,
harden our hearts or we open our hearts.
And those are big, crucial turning points.
Yeah.
Let me give another example, just if people are unclear about what I'm talking about. It's possible that I might forgive my husband who has had an affair, ask him to come back into my life. Not because I'm really being merciful to him, perhaps, but because I'm so afraid of loneliness. And so it might have nothing to do with a softening of my heart or a extension of forgiveness to him, but me again protecting myself from the loneliness that I'm afraid to feel. So it's really the opposite of building a softer heart. It's really hardening or maintaining the idol of comfort that I've had in my life. That makes sense to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And undoubtedly, I'm welcoming my husband back into my home, but not into my heart. There will be bitterness and resentment that's still there. And so that will block any real commitment in the marriage. It's a recipe for disaster, I would imagine.
Very often. Though, obviously, God could even use that.
Sure. Oh, yeah, sure.
This process, Jack, is something that people think they should get through quickly, and I really want to emphasize again that I often work with people who will spend literally months and years getting through all these idols one layer at a time, because there's a labyrinth of them, to finally get to a reality of what their heart looks like and be able to extend mercy to another person. Certainly, that's true in my life. I find myself bumping up against idols that I don't know are there, or maybe they were 100-foot tall idols and now they're only 50 feet, but they're still pretty formidable for me. And so it's this process of going through this softening all the time in my life. I do, however, find that at this point in my life, it's easier for me to forgive. A few days ago, my daughter said to me, you know, Mom, a situation came up where people had, my daughter became aware of some people that had been hurtful toward me. And, you know, people around on the holidays that aren't usually, and she heard some conversations, and she came up to me and said, Mom, do you hate so-and-so for doing that? And it was a hard question to answer, in part because I didn't want to say it's no big deal. I didn't want to tell her, oh no, I'm fine, things are great. Because in that sense, it is hard for me. I mean, my heart aches with it. But what I ended up doing, which is kind of typical for me, is I kind of started crying and said, no, I really don't hate them, but I sure wish God for them. I wish that they could have God so their hearts would be softened and changed. And yeah, they really did hurt me, but how can I not want God for anybody?
Mm-hmm.
Even those people who have been very hurtful to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's encouraging to see that I'm coming to that place. Now, if you up and hit me or hurt one of my children right now, I don't think immediately I would feel forgiving towards you or want good for you immediately. I don't see that. But I see that happening in my mind much more quickly than it would have 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a couple of things we need to keep in mind to keep this in perspective. I agree with you that this forgiveness that you're talking about can be a long process. What could be confusing to people is, well, he says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Am I not qualified for this mercy until I'm at the end of this process then? And I think the answer to that is no, because to be merciful in the way that I think Jesus has in mind here is to simply be someone who, from deep inside themselves, is committed to mercy as a principle, as a reality, as a value that they truly, objectively hold. I think you described earlier someone who is really struggling with being forgiving, but their heart attitude is, I want to be forgiving. You know, God teach me to be forgiving. Well, that's someone who is committed to that as a value. the forgiveness may not have become mature, maybe is a good word to use. The forgiveness may not have become mature such that it really completely controls their emotional and psychological experience.
Or maybe it controls very little of it.
Or controls little of it. But the fact that they can say, I want to be forgiving, is a very, very important reality, a very...
That's it.
Yeah, it's a very dramatic commitment to something that is true and is an indication of our sanctification, is an indication that we will receive mercy. Now, it's not that we can't fake that. I mean, we can say, I really want to be forgiving and not really want to be forgiving, but if those words express something that's really truly in our heart, then the fact that we struggle emotionally, psychologically, that our mind is often tempted to anger and bitterness and revenge, and I struggle with that daily, that's not necessarily an indication that I'm not being merciful.
Or more than even being tempted by anger or rage, I find myself enraged.
Well, yeah, and that's what I mean, is I find myself enraged, but finding myself enraged, the question is, what is my heart going to do with that? How am I going to resolve that? Am I going to own that, or am I going to repudiate it and say to myself, that is not the place I want my heart to rest, and do everything I can to distance myself from it. The fact that I struggle with that distance does not mean I'm not committed to mercy. It just means it's hard for me, and I'm not mature in my commitment. The more mature I am, probably the easier that gets. But
okay, but
few
I have to go
mature.
Back. Few of us are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was that mature guy? I think his name was Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
Do you remember him? That guy. He's the mature one.
But I don't mean perfect. You know, I don't mean perfectly good. I mean, I do think that there is a state that we can get to in this lifetime where these values become really, really important to us. And the more we approach that point where they are the controlling realities of our lives, I do think we struggle less the closer we get to that.
You're right. And I think that's what I...
That's what you were saying
describing.
About how much easier it is than it used to be to forgive.
And so this is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I'm going to go on it for a minute. You said that when I find myself enraged, that I want to repudiate it and not just stand on that and embrace that. You said something like that. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, Jack, I have to say that sometimes we are so... I guess I want to use the word constipated in our ability to even recognize what we have denied for so long. We have, for example, using our example from a few minutes ago, perhaps I have been so unwilling to look at the sin in my own heart that I won't look at the sin in other people, that I don't have a clue about the fact that I'm a person who can be angry or even perhaps be sad or be jealous or hurtful in some way. And when I start moving into recognizing those things, there is also an emotional reaction. It's not just a cognitive thing, but my whole being gets wound up in a recognition of this. In the midst of that kind of recognition, and there's a tumultuous disequilibrium in my life, and I may indeed be a person who becomes very angry. I've held that down for so long. Perhaps I need to have an expression of that that's been bottled up for a very, very long time. Do I express that rage toward, using my example, my husband who leaves me? Do I hurt them with my rage? No. But do I seek out a person who has an understanding of what I'm going through and be able to live with the disequilibrium that I'm in right now and be able to hold that rage with me and understand it as perhaps the doorway through which I will enter into a softness of heart down the road? That's what I need to do. But for me to keep not allowing the emotional expression of the reality that I'm starting to understand have any kind of life could hold me back from ultimately recognizing the sin in my own heart.
Okay.
I see your eyes working.
I'm not sure I'm following. I'm not sure I'm following.
Say if I think that anger is unrighteous. And so although I might be full of rage and anger toward my relative who molested me, I will never express that because I have a sense of that being something that doesn't look spiritual, that doesn't look good. Well, the reality is...
So I mask it.
I mask it.
Okay.
I deny it. I walk away from it.
I see what you're saying.
I'm trying to remember the language you used earlier. You didn't use denial. You used some other...
I don't remember either.
Okay.
But I see what you're saying. Yeah, because the anger is there. It's just that I'm pretending it's not there, and I'm masking it, and I'm stuffing it, and I'm deflecting it, and I'm sticking it off in some corner of my mind where I refuse to...
Even know it exists.
I refuse to know it exists, yeah.
And I might truly not even know. 10 years ago, someone might have come to me, or 1 year ago, whoever, whatever, and come to me with the same issue, you know, saying my father molested me. And I would say, well, what you need to do is just rejoice in the Lord. Well, that now you're saved, or, you know, or...
So you really think they don't know it's there at all? I mean,
Absolutely,
really?
Jack. For some people, they just are so dissociated from their being. They don't understand that in the depth of their heart. Now, I'd say a lot of people know it. They might just know a shadow of it. They might know it big and then stuff it down really quickly. But there are some people who absolutely do not have a sense of that. They have become people who are so split off from the reality of what's going on in their heart. From their own emotional...
I'll trust you. I don't think I've ever experienced that, because every time I have denied and tried to mask the reality of what's going on, in retrospect, I mean, if you had asked me at the time, did that bother you, or were you angry about that, or did you, you know, what was your reaction to that? And I will pretend like it's okay and say that it's okay, but in retrospect, I knew all along that it was not okay. And in fact, I mean, it's almost humorous.
Not okay that you were angry.
Yeah, I mean, what I mean is, I know that I knew all along that my reaction was one of anger, that I really was angry, or I really was hateful, or I really was something. I really was bothered in some way by something that happened. The very thing I was saying, it didn't bother me.
Right.
And I mean, there's some, especially early in our marriage, I can remember Jody kind of probing. Well, did that bother you? Oh, no, it didn't bother me. I think it bothered you. And then the anger would come out.
It didn't bother me.
So I wasn't very good at it. But there was always a side of me that knew what I was doing. I mean, I would never admit it to myself. I was proudly and stubbornly going to insist that I am responding the way I think I ought to respond to this. But I knew better than that all along.
Yeah, well, but Jack, I mean, you're coming from your own perspective.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying.
I think that's very normal, very typical, that we'll do that, that we'll know what's going on, but we'll deny it at the same time, and later have to come back and go, oh, you know, I really was wrong, or there's too much evidence after I yelled at you when I said I wasn't angry. Oh, well, I guess I find that I really was angry. But there are people, Jack, and I know I keep coming back to this, and but we have letters from people who write me and say, I'm glad that you understand the extent of the suffering in my heart. So I'm going to keep holding a torch for those people. People that I understand and know pretty intimately through my work. And there are people, Jack, that truly have been so wounded that they don't recognize any feeling inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
Who don't... I remember one time a woman came to me and she, I'm going to change the issue... let's say that she was shoplifting, and she came to me kind of, she got caught, brought in, brought to me for counsel. And she said, you know, I just don't know why I did it. I think it's very silly that I'm even here. It's just a fluke that I steal things. You know, I do it, but it's just kind of a quirk in my personality. And I said, well, you know what I'd like you to do is just spend some time thinking about your life and maybe seeing if there might be a connection between what you're doing, shoplifting, and any events that have occurred in your life. Because for me, this is a symptom of something else that's going on inside of her. She had absolutely no awareness of it, but the next time she met with me, she came with a 15-page paper on things that have happened in her life. Absolutely gruesome, horrifying, terrible things. One was that she found her mother hanging in the cellar, in the basement, when she was a young child. Her mother had killed herself. I read through that, and mentioned it, talked to her about, in fact, that one in particular, and she said, well, that was a long time ago. I don't know why you're even bringing that up as something that it might bother me. This is a person that was totally cut off from the reality of the issues in her own life and was so hurt by those, so traumatized by them, that she had constricted her own awareness.
Okay.
Working with that, that's way on the one end of the continuum, all the way up to the other end, we nonetheless very often try to constrict emotions within us that bring up issues that might be very frightening for us. So that release of emotional energy that comes with a recognition of something that we're becoming aware of cognitively is a match that must happen as a process toward our softening of heart. Do I use my rage or my anger, do I traumatize somebody else with it? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But do I allow myself to recognize the pain, the anger, the rage that's inside of me? Yes. Very often, again, that's a door through which my heart will be softened. That's part of the process that I may need to go through to get to that ultimate place. And for me to think it's spiritual to continue to be constricted and dissociated and split off from the reality of my own heart is simply wrong. It's sin.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the New Testament calls hypocrisy. To try to slap on the outside a facsimile of goodness and righteousness rather than face honestly the actual stuff that is coming out of my heart so that I or anybody else does not, in an attempt to keep other people or myself from seeing it, there's no merit in that. There's no virtue in that. That's not righteousness. That's hypocrisy.
I think you're exactly right. That is hypocrisy, and I think that's the essence of hypocrisy, but I think we've renamed it and called it spirituality.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what the Pharisees did. They thought that was what recommended them to God. Their hypocrisy was the righteousness that they had constructed for themselves.
They're glittering images.
Right.
But they're not real. They're an image.
Yeah.
They're not reality.
Totally plastic and totally counterfeit, yeah. And Jesus warns us. He says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. It's not just a psychological problem, it's a sociological problem. We encourage it in one another.
Mm-hmm.
We create cultures that expect it of one another. And it's a very, very deadly, serious spiritual disease.
And when I'm going through very often, when people are going through this unmasking of themselves, of looking beyond their hypocrisy, very often it's a sociological problem again in that they need to hide. They feel like if anybody sees them on the outside, they're going to be completely dismembered, or they're going to be, what is it that the Catholics used to do, or maybe they still do?
Excommunicated,
in a sense. Can you imagine a Pharisee who's in a sense coming out, recognizing that they have just had this completely false and phony relationship with God, that they see that they're blowing their bugle in the streets to show that they're giving a tithe is actually, in reality, a humiliating thing to remember or to think about. They're just struck with how wrong it is. What they're going to look like is people who are not strong and straight-backed and walking proudly on the street. They're going to look like people who are bowed over, and if they really get the sin in their heart, they're going to bow over. They're going to be crying. They're going to be grieving. They're going to be in a place where perhaps all sorts of emotions from other things are coming up for them that they never even knew. They may even, Jack, wonder if they were ever believers.
Absolutely. Sure.
Maybe they weren't. And that's what happens in my office a lot. People thought they had this very strong and sincere and big and backbone relationship with God, and all of a sudden they go through this recognition of themselves, and they're splayed out.
Right.
They don't look spiritual in the way that they understood it at all. Questions abound in their mind. They have to go through a whole new, almost redirecting of their whole life. It's major.
Mm-hmm.
And people around them very often say, hurry up, you've grieved enough. But if they've been a Pharisee for 45 years of their life, and all of a sudden they're walking into awareness of the reality of their hearts. Wow.
Yeah. I've just been studying the conversion of Paul, And that Paul is a classic example of that, a Pharisee of Pharisees. But you can see by his life that there's really nothing authentic about his love for God at all. I mean, he doesn't really love God, but he thought he did. You know, he thought he was the biggest lover of God on the planet, I think. But he had to crash and burn to finally come to realize that all of what he thought was true spirituality was not even spirituality at all. It was totally counterfeit.
Jack, what do you think his crash and burn look like? I mean, in reality, if you were sitting in his house with him.
Yeah, we don't have enough details to know the specifics of it, but he didn't eat and drink for 3 days after he... I mean, a lot of people see his conversion as seeing Jesus on the road to Damascus. That wasn't his conversion. That was just the thing that totally made him crash and burn. For 3 days, he couldn't eat and drink.
He was so devastated.
Yeah. And it was at the end of that time that then God sends a man, Ananias, a prophet, to Paul. And evidently, Paul, something has happened that Paul is open. And a word from Ananias, and Paul is baptized, and he gets up and eats and drinks, Luke says. Whatever the load was is lifted. Whatever the chaos becomes resolved. But it was seems like it was a hell of a 3 days for Paul. That was pretty traumatic.
I wish God would just give 3 days to most of the people I work with, you know?
Yeah.
I wish he'd send Ananias, but, you know, most often he doesn't.
Yeah, that's not typical, yeah. In my sanctification process, I can remember one issue that took over a year, of really torturous, tormented by fighting psychologically, not wanting to... I don't even know. I mean, to this day, it's not clear what was being resolved, but God was working overtime to get me to see myself and establish a whole different value system. And I fought it for a whole year. And I was tormented during that time.
How were you tormented? How did you fight it?
I can't get into the specifics because it involves other people, and I can't go public for them. But basically, I wanted the world to be a certain way that I had been taught that it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that God would reward me for my righteousness by making this world be everything that he had promised it to be.
That you thought he'd promised
it. That I thought he had promised it to be. And lo and behold, the world didn't work that way. That's not the way the world was going to be.
But how did you fight to get the world to be that way? Did you go through a range of emotions? Did you pout in your room? Did you get crabby to your kids? Can you identify some of the things that happened?
My mind raced to try to rationalize everything that I knew was true, to convince myself that the lie was true rather than the truth was true.
So your mind was working overtime.
And I thought I was going crazy. I mean, I literally thought I was going crazy at times because I couldn't stop my mind from trying to make falsehood truth and truth falsehood.
And that's what makes us crazy.
Yeah.
Is to switch the truth for a lie and the lie for a truth.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself without energy?
Yeah, I imagine I would call it depressed at times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe having a hard time concentrating on things because you were so
taken
up in this.
Upset,
so
yeah.
Distracted, so
yeah.
Upset.
Yeah.
Sometimes grumpy.
Probably. I wasn't aware enough.
Should
of
I ask your wife?
I wasn't married.
Oh.
But I wasn't aware enough of other people to know whether I was grumpy. I was pretty inside myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very preoccupied.
Okay. That is the essence of craziness, when we're trying to create a reality that isn't true. And that happens, either we go crazy or we shut down a complete awareness because it becomes too difficult, or we keep changing reality enough and finding people around us to give us support for the reality that we're creating so that we don't have to face it. And what God does in his mercy is to break through to the reality, as I think you're describing in this situation in your life, to make you have to face into what's true.
Mm-hmm.
But the process of it sometimes absolutely floors us I know a lot of people who would say to me, I think I'm crazy,
mm-hmm.
or I think I'm going crazy, or I think maybe I am crazy.
And I think I can, I mean, I don't know everybody who's a believer, but it just seems to me, given what our sanctification is all about, that all of us who have genuinely come to true belief have gone through experiences like that of one kind or another, one way or another. I don't see any other way there. And it's not abnormal. I think that's what people need to recognize. It's not abnormal that we have those really terrible traumatic times. That's the process of rebirth. To be born again is a very excruciating and agonizing time for everybody, I think. And I, you know, why did I survive it? It's the grace of God. I mean, that there's no other explanation. And that's what we can count on, is that God is not going to destroy us through this process. He's going to create us through this process. He's making us new. He might be destroying something in us that needs to be destroyed, and that's why it hurts so much. But he's not destroying it in order to destroy us. He's destroying that in order to recreate us. And that's the thing we need to hold on to and say, go ahead, God, you have my permission. It's when we fight it that it's terrible.
I have to say, Jack, I love this conversation, because you're following me and understanding this process that lots of people go through, and we're kind of going public with something that's really not ever gone public with, hardly at all, in the Christian community. And I am so excited that we've been able to say these things and understand them together here today. So, Jack, actually, I have a couple of quotes. I just ran and got this because I really like it. It's a few quotes that someone gave me, and I framed it and stuck it in my office. There's a book called Glittering Images. We talked about glittering images earlier in our conversation, and it's by Susan Howatch. And she writes about the clergy, the Episcopalian clergy in England, and about their hypocrisy, and tries to unmask it. And they're just fascinating books, both spiritually and psychologically. She is, I don't think her theology would always match mine, but certainly they are revealing books and very interesting to me. So I had one of the people I work with read this book one time, and she just loved it, and she wrote down these quotes for me. And I think they really go along with what we're talking about today. Which is better, to express grief and pain by using tear ducts especially created for the purpose, or to express grief and pain by enduring a silent, secret hemorrhage of the soul?
Hmm.
Do you see the connection here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another one. Do you think God's been unaware of your difficulties and the suffering you must inevitably have endured? And do you think he's incapable of reaching out at last to bring you face to face with your troubles so that you can surmount them to go on to serve him far better than you served him in the past?
Did you say far better than you served him in the
past? Yeah. Far better than you served him in the past. And I think that's what we're talking about, is that God reaches into our suffering and matures us through it.
Right.
And then the last one. God hasn't sent this ordeal to destroy you, Charles. He's come to your rescue at last. And have in this village, have in this house, have in this room, where you've hit rock bottom, here's where your new life finally begins.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I think very often we feel like the ordeals that we're going through are here to destroy us. And I think, as you said just a minute ago, quite the opposite is true. God's not destroying us. It's through bringing us face to face with the reality in our lives that life is created.
The way Jesus said it is, he said to his disciples, unless a seed go into the ground and die, it cannot bring forth life. And I think that's what he was talking about.
I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. And what does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following The students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. And throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you are interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College.
So Jack and I have done some talking about how do we ask people for money, since both of us, as you know, are not very good at doing that. One of the things that Jack has been very adamant about is that we don't kind of manipulate people, that we don't set them up, that we don't try to make you guys feel bad or feel something in order to push you to contribute to the program. And one of the ways that we're trying not to do that is to combine asking for your prayer, asking for your letters, and at the same time, asking for financial support. But Jack, today I'm going to break that rule because we got a letter in the mail that combined those two, and it's a good letter, and I'd like to read it.
Okay.
Dear Christine and Jack, I continue to build my Sundays around your programs, and I continue to tape on Sunday and play back several times during the week until the next Sunday. Also, I have written pages to you about almost every Sunday's program. I never seem to get them typed and sent off to you. Just to hear you absolutely echoes my thoughts, especially what Jack says through your questions to him, Christine, in God's Word. God bless you both. I feel very blessed to be in the ground floor of your programs. I will try to send $25 per month, and I pray that your other avid listeners, at least 50 others, will do the same. Just send that reminder envelope each month. Thank you for your wonderful program. Pretty encouraging, isn't that, Jack?
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, we really do love receiving these letters. And we don't receive tons of them. We would like more to get your feedback, to get your questions, to get your thoughts. So if this program is beneficial to you, please send your financial contributions. We sure can use them.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.